Thank you. It's it's truly an opportunity to be part of this distinguished group that I think about half of us were in an NC Regional Research Committee or an NE Regional Research Committee that Ray was a part of. So was Bill Larson, of course. And in fact, the first time I remember meeting Ray, I think, was at the NATO Soil Mechanics Symposium you had at Minnesota. When was that? 82? 3, 4. So it's been a very good relationship that we've had with Ray at Michigan State. If I were to give him a subtitle, I'd say he's a transformer of conservation to sustainability. You know, conservation was a big buzzword of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. Sustainability, even as our keynote speaker last evening reminded us that this whole concept of conservation is essential to have a set of a very applied and useful methods of ethos to develop a sustainable system. So without too many more comments, I'd like to just say, by way of introduction of what we will talk about today, is that Ray Almaris was not only a lifetime mentor, but he was an encourager. We heard that before. But, you know, he would come through these regional research committees, and he's always had something good to say at the beginning. And then he said, you know, you might want to do this about that as well. I think some of us heard that. Perhaps his daughters heard it more than most of us, right? But what I like about Ray's work is he was committed to remind us all that life's greatest calling is to serve others. He certainly, and we've heard about that today, and particularly to help them enjoy the basic human rights, including the greatest right to not go hungry. It was just a few years ago, 6 years ago, soil science finally was promoted to be published in the Science Journal, Tier 1 journal. And some of these concepts were brought to the fore, and our understanding of the below ground functions are very, very limited. Some people call it black boxes of pores. Microbiologists say there are billions of bacteria we don't even classify, haven't been able to classify. And there are certainly myriads of microsites, but there's so much going on, not only in cation exchange capacity and ions and water, but in the microbial, the carbon sequestration, and many of the mesofauna, bacteria and fungi as well. So what I'd like to do is build on that and simply remind us of this complexity that Ray taught us and all of us who've worked in soils are very familiar with, that Mike Miller and Julie Jastrow, by the way, Julie's giving one of the very fine invited keynotes tomorrow, I believe it is, and I'd encourage you to listen to her presentation. But during a sabbatical I spent with them, it became much more clear of the importance of understanding not just the physics and the biophysics and the biogeochemistry of soil, but a whole lot more about the meso and microfauna that seems to keep this whole process moving. And Ray recognized this. I would call it the three C's of Ray Almaris's research. We've heard all about this, but I'd like to just highlight two or three of these. Minimize soil disturbance and compaction, accumulate these residues on the soil surface, and then the one that we interfaced most with was reduction of soil erosion, improve water use efficiency, and increase soil carbon. That whole concept of not only his publications, but many, many, many others in this room and beyond, we began to think through what are some of the biogeochemical processes inside of aggregates that are really causing aggregates to be more stable as more soil carbon is added. Of course, then he was very concerned about some of the fossil fuel consumption by conventional tillage. He also produced this whole focus of the triple C's of cover cropping and crop rotation, keeping it green. It was mentioned earlier, so I'll pass over those with one exception that I'd like to speak a little bit about, varying that last one of crop rotation, varying the types of crops grown on the same real estate does reduce diseases, and we'll talk a little more about that. And what I liked about Ray's approach, and it has been addressed here, he really looked at the speed of bringing new ideas to the farmer and how this changed people's lives. Here's a quote that Ray probably said in public about every meeting I attended. And when I would exchange some ideas with him over the phone or just hallway conversations, he said, "Remember, Al, root studies in soils are complex." Well, I'd be the second one to agree with that. All of us who've worked with roots know the complexity. And you know, I've spent a lifetime, many of you spent a lifetime looking at roots and mesofauna. And for those of you who are just about a generation younger than us, there's a whole lifetime ahead of you to look at roots in soils. And hopefully you'll continue to make progress. There are billions of bacteria per gram of soil. Okay, with this by way of background, I think it was in the 1980s, Ray said, you know, there's probably at one of these regional research meetings, there's probably an unknown flux rate of carbon in macro aggregates that none of us know about. Well, this was a good time for us to look at the C13 concepts that are in natural carbon components that are different with C4 and C3 plants. And we just happened to have a very nice long-term ecological research project at Kellogg Biological Station where we had many, many years of corn. Corn is a C4 plant, so the C13 delta signal was a bit lower. It was somewhere in the neighborhood of minus 17 part per mil. And all of us who know and raise alfalfa know that's a C3 plant. So the C13 signal is in the mid-20s, 23, 24, sometimes as high as 25 if you get into the root system. So we began to track that over many years. I had a graduate student, Sanchez, who was working with us from Brazil. He looked at three aggregates, and he had some numbers. And I said, well, this is another thing I learned from Ray. You know, you scratch your head a little bit and say, three replications in a field. Mm-hmm. We might want a few more. So we got six or eight more. We ended up with 15 to 20. I forgot the exact number. And this is the number that we came across as we began to identify the root, the movement of the carbon from this particular alfalfa set of roots attached or at least very adjacent to a soil aggregate. These soil aggregates were pretty macro, as you can see. We chose them large enough so we could find a gradient, right? If you get too small, you may not find the gradient. And we had just developed a way to peel these surfaces off so we could look at gradients across the surface of the interior. And the summary is that in a field where there's a lot of wetting and drying, this was over a 20-month period of time, we saw and could calculate approximately 7 times 10 to the minus 4 millimeter of this carbon movement per hour. And most of the carbon stayed in the exterior. This is 2/3 of the carbon in the exterior was this amount. About 43% of the carbon in this region was of the new carbon from the root. The center had no carbon. We'll talk about more about that as we move on. No new carbon. So as we began to look at carbon solution flow through roots and what happens around roots and into soils, we chose one and said, okay, there must be a whole group of gradients here, not only of carbon, but also of porosities, ions, oxygen, and biotic compounds. And we'll talk about that as we move through the system today. Ray said more than once, soil compaction interferes with normal root function. Oh, yes. How do we identify that? He said, Smucker, you've got some good ideas. Why don't you develop a new system so that we can now look at three dimensions of aggregate? I think he just knew it was a lot of work. But the short term is we got a couple publications out of it. Some of those were while he was in Washington, other parts while he was back in the Midwest. But it was a very good opportunity to develop models based upon what we had sorted out in the field. John Ferguson, who now is back in Oregon working with ARS, developed this model for me. And we could begin to show very pictorially, two-dimensionally, that what happens when we compact at these very shallow root systems. And we went through a whole series. You can just see this very quickly, what happens when we compact the soil surface too closely. So the subsoil too closely to the surface. Here's just one of several photos plus a whole lot of other data that Daniel Rassi published in it was the early 90s. And we did this work across 4 years, and we came to the conclusion that here's part of the rotation effect. If we plant corn after corn after corn, we begin to see these fusarium-based, perhaps other type of fungal necrotic regions on these roots. If we have a rotation of 2 or 3 years with alfalfa, we see very clean corn roots. Even though it doesn't kill all the roots, it certainly does reduce the sorption. So again, it was not just Ray, but I saw Betty Klepper was here earlier, the group in Auburn, the root group. They said, you know, what we really need is a much more quantitative system of separating roots from soils. Well, we got to thinking about this, scratched our heads, and it turned out to be this. Let's go this way. This kind of hydrogenic lutriation system where we can recover 98% or 99% of the roots. I still have colleagues at Michigan State, though, that I see some of their students carrying roots through the hallways, and I said, how did you wash that? Well, we just got a bucket of water and shook it back and forth. I said, how many roots did you float away? They smiled. They said, well, somewhere around half. So there is a better way. It was at the same time that ARS came to the rescue to Smucker et al. Of Michigan State by the name of Joe Ritchie. Joe Ritchie, as some of you know, did move from Texas to Michigan State, accepted an endowed professorship, and along with some of his agreements with the administration were to buy some new mini Rizotron cameras. Well, he could purchase two, and he gave us one. We began to look at what was happening to the root systems as they grew in compacted and non-compacted soils. And Eileen, you're the one that talked all about these wormholes and so forth and how the macropores are just very nice highways for roots. Well, we've got multiple pictures of those. This is just one. And the other thing is that some of you who have a lifetime to do research, we saw this hundreds of thousands of times. We published it a little bit. We thought we came up with a new idea. We got the whole manuscript together, and I think yes, a few of you in this room were with us at the time. We said, oh, fantastic new idea. And we looked in the literature, and it was discovered in this University of Chicago in 1904. but here's what's happening. Every time you see a concave bend in a root, there's no branching. Branching is always on the convex side, okay? And it happens over and over. Here's another situation, but what I wanted to show you here, we could see mesofauna. We could observe the growth of nodules and any other components. Again, branching, okay, only in the convex side, yes. Let's move on, though. What the mini Rizotron could help us understand is how many roots are grow and die per day. This is across a five-year period. As you can see with alfalfa, we had a very severe drought in 1991 and early 92. But the point was we lost so many roots in this soil, upper soil surface, and there was so much death. Whatever is below zero here, of course, is death. And as we looked at this across the whole group of plants, and Rob Aiken, who's here today, was a co-author in this publication. That was just a few years ago, Rob, that growth and death of these ephemeral roots were very, very high. If we saw a drying condition of a corn plant, we saw this explosion of finer roots, which died just within a few megapascals of change in the water content. And as the soil dried deeper, there was this growth and death. So we lost somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,700 roots per meter squared over a very short period of time. And of course, once you get all these images, how do you process them? Well, we developed an image processing system. It worked up. The other thing I wanted to mention is that Ray at this time was in Oregon, and he was working with the plant breeders and plant pathologists, and those of you who work with plant breeders recognize, at least historically, that usually they get these selected seeds that might be two plants that produce 5 seeds or 15 seeds or 50 seeds, and they really don't want to lose the seedling, but they still want to test for root resistance to soil compaction. So we developed this little root penetration ratio system where we had low bulk density, high bulk density, low bulk density. You can change fertility, you can change bacteria, you can change a whole bunch of things, aeration and so forth this little sandwich, and we could come up very quickly with what we call the root penetration ratio, and show that if the compaction is pretty high, the RPI is about 40. RPR is about 0.4 or 43%, and we can check this out with many, many others. Okay, moving right along, what I'd like to address now is what several of you have talked about of plant root growth in the compacted soils. This was Ray's pet interest for, I don't know, perhaps most of his career, but he focused on it for a decade or and a half. And he began to ask the question, what happens when these aggregates are being pushed together, the air is removed, most of the pore space is filled with water, there's anaerobic situations that occur, there are gradients then of losses of carbon away from the root into the aggregates. And so we asked the question, which we finally answered in somewhere about 205, can we simulate the system that's in the real world where we send aggregates through dry wetting cycles? This was 0 to 5, we have another in here in a bit, we'll talk about 0 to 9. On average, in a tilled soil, a surface 5 centimeters of soil, aggregates will go through 15 to 35 wetting and drying cycles each season. This is in Michigan. In the tropics, it's probably 3 times that. So we know that whatever is happening with this wet dry cycle, it will influence how much carbon is absorbed in the exteriors, transition interiors of aggregates, and that seems to continue. We've taken it up to 15, and we see a more or less linear relationship. As long as there is carbon available, we use C13 glucose in this situation so we can follow it, but it really gave us a perspective of what happens at the surfaces of aggregates and how that changes to the interiors. Again, we'll talk about that in a few moments here. About 15 years ago, maybe it was 20, we were asking the question again, what happens at the soil surface when these roots are moving down through the soil? They absorb water, of course, dry out the aggregates. If it's too dry or too compacted, or just normal growth, there'll be a lot of carbon lost into these aggregates. How can we simulate that? Well, about that time, there were some very nice suctionized simulators about 10 centimeters long, and each of these had Teflon material that had a 0.3 to 1.5 micron pore size. So it really simulated a route to push out solutions or to pull in solutions from adjacent soils. We had a graduate student that worked on this, and he did a very fine job of showing if we just had pure water coming out of these artificial roots, we call them rhizomes. So we looked at 3 different tillages of this Kalamazoo loam soil, conventional tillage, minimum tillage, and native grassland. This native grassland had not been plowed for about 40 years. Minimum tillage had not been plowed for about 5 or 7. Conventional, of course, was continuously plowed. And as we looked at the differences between just water and carbon and nitrogen compounds in that water, we could see that if we take the bulk soil of the conventional as 100%, the mean weight diameters of these aggregates increased fourfold as we took them through 9 wetting and drying cycles. This is exactly what Ray had mentioned in his publications and continuously told us something is happening interior in these aggregates, and he said it's for you young guys to figure it out, okay? And he always loved to do that because he said, well, he only had about 10 or 12 or 15 years to finish, and we had 3 times that much. So he took us down the track of encouragement in that way. But what was so nice about it is as we began to look at the different tillage and native succession of grassland, we saw a diminishing mean weight diameter with just the 9 wetting and drying cycles. However, as we added the carbon, we saw these increases with the conventional, which had lower carbon. Even the minimum went up fourfold to the standard. And these in native grasslands, which had a lot of carbon, a lot of roots, a lot of mesofauna, a lot of earthworms, a lot of bacteria and fungi, these things were not increasing very fast, even with increasing carbon nitrogen compounds. Now, here's the summary of what we thought was happening In the short term, as we looked at soils in Michigan, we worked with Warren Dick at Ohio State, where many of you know they have 100-year plus of continuous moreboard plow, and now they have, I think next year is going to be their 50th, so this is 7 years old. But this is the data that we looked at of what is the quantity of carbon in the exteriors versus interiors of all the aggregates. These are five different classes from 1 to 9.5 across. We compared that with the reduced carbon inputs over the 100 years of the conventional tillage. And we saw three things. First of all, the gradient of carbon on the exteriors to the interiors was 160% for the minimum tillage or no moldboard. Here we had, for the conventional tillage, roughly an equal amount or even a negative. Well, okay, we can look at that and say that's what's influencing the stability of aggregates as carbon moves to the interiors and makes them stronger because of mesofauna, the fungi, et cetera. But then the real catch was how much carbon was going into that soil during these 43 years of minimum tillage, roughly 340 kilograms of carbon per hectare per year. How did that compare with the continuous tillage? Roughly a negative 230. So we've got somewhere in the neighborhood of about 570 kilograms of carbon different. And these are just looking at individual aggregates. Let's move on. So we came to a conclusion. We said, okay, we're right here with the carbon sequestration in soil. If we begin to adjust some of these aggregates and change the pores, we can begin to take the soil carbon much higher than current models are suggesting is the maximum. I'll let you just think about that and agree or disagree. Another thing that I remember, a comment by Ray, and it was perhaps some of the rest of you in this room, at one of our regional meetings was, hey, the folks over in the Netherlands are doing a fantastic job with field lysimeters. What are you young guys doing in America of putting lysimeters together and begin to measure? Well, fortunately, we had some funding with the LTR at KBS. So we put these stainless steel systems in to cost us. I think it cost us $170,000 each, so we could only afford four of them. But nonetheless, we have replications to this day. Mini rhizotrons, TDRs, suction lysimeters, thermal couples, etc. And going back to comments earlier, we've got some very nice ways to measure water and thermal. All of these experiences, I give some contributions to Ray, to many of you in this room, because we had this constant communication that Ray and others have displayed for us of multidisciplinary interactions. Soil scientists need to have a knowledge, at least a working knowledge, in engineering as well as biology. One of the things I learned back in 1966 was that subsurface water retention technology can change things. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. And I'm going to take the privilege here to add, based on the experiences we've learned in regional research plus our own, of what has taken us now to a process that can easily transform lives and landscapes. What is it? It's a revolutionary green initiative. It enhances food and cellulose production between 40 and 400%. It sustainably manages sandy soils and deserts. It can also be used to conserve soil and water resources in any soil type. And very briefly, it's a new technology. It's been tested for the past 40 plus years. It started out as using asphalt, and there we were criticized a lot because, well, asphalt's a pretty dirty, crusty, high metal material. But I've been following these barriers now for roughly 48 years. There's not a single heavy metal, not a single microbial population difference, not a single change in the mesofauna immediately above or immediately below. It's that inert. So if these are installed spatially distributed within the root zone, it can transform sandy soils into very highly productive food-producing and, of course, fiber-producing systems. I'm going to go back and make a comment. Years ago, in 1960s, late 60s, the Erickson and Hansen and others made a solid barrier of asphalt, okay, straight across. This worked beautifully if it were in a semi-arid region and irrigation were the only source or the primary source of water. But every once in a while, especially in our discussions, well, our experiments with Luke Hammond and others at the University of Florida, they would get 3 or 4 inches and just simply flood this so the water was saturated, anaerobic conditions, and of course that would reduce yields. So we lost some yields as a result. Let me go on to say where we are today. We're going back to this idea of lysimeters, huge lysimeters, where we can put in different kinds of materials. We could take suction lysimeters. We have, I think it's 27 of these to follow the nutrients. We have 90-some of these. TDRs, yes, Burl, it is a whole lot different than we used to have with the TDRs before TOP. Very briefly, what we can do with the barriers is we can irrigate or it could rain to the near maximum water holding capacity, drain out, irrigate again, drain out, irrigate, and drain out. And if we look at the regular sandy soil, its equilibration is somewhere in the 10 to 12%. In this one, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of the high teens, 18, 19, 20. So we can double that water holding capacity. So with that kind of water holding capacity, now this is the data in the past 40 years. There are some 38 publications, not just ours, but others. But it does increase yields and water use efficiency and the economics of irrigation. Just quickly, 200% of vegetables, of cabbage, 150% of potatoes, cucumbers 200%. And in those days, it cost $360 an acre. It's probably going to be $800 this year. And it pays for itself in 1 year. What do? We simply look at now using Sawluth models, and this is where my co-author, Bruno Basso, is involved. He couldn't be here because he's presenting the Sawluth model just down the hallway. But it's a very good way to identify what will happen if we begin to put these barriers into sandy soil. A control in Brisbane, Australia, using 30 years of data, and they have 37 other parameters on the climate and the soils, they'll get somewhere around 2,000. With the barrier, they can get up to 7,000 kilograms per hectare of maize. That's a 287% increase with essentially very little irrigation. Sandy loams, of course, it's not quite as big a difference because sandy loams hold more water. If we irrigate, it's still more production. Wheat, which is seldom irrigated, but we still wanted to test, gave us an 68%. So there is that potential. I just wanted to stop and say this is where I think we, as scientists who have had a large number of mentors, such as Dr. Elmris, and also how we can integrate from our colleagues, many of you in this room, put it into an opportunity that's going to take us, I think, to another level of understanding of how we can now move some of the research and some of the productivity onto what we used to refer to as marginal soils and not, and I emphasize, not use 7 times the quantity of water that potato folks are using on sandy soils in Wisconsin and Michigan, and leaching about 80% of the nitrates they're adding to the groundwater. And with this system, now we can begin to establish the first anaerobic sites in sandy soil. As those of you who are biodegradation folks know, anaerobic microbes can break down the pyridines and pyrimidines of pesticides. Aerobes can't, okay? So we can now begin to biodegrade many of these toxic pesticides and so forth. So with that, I'll stop and say it's been a pleasure getting to see many of you today, and we thank, along with most of you and all of you, I'm sure, Ray Almaris's contribution to our lives. Thank you.
We have a break after this talk, so we have a couple minutes for questions if you'd like to ask Al some questions.
Yeah. Glad you asked. Tomorrow at 10:20, I'm going to give the whole 9 yards. But just very briefly, the only reason I can talk about it today is the patent was approved 3 days ago, Michigan State. So we had to just sit on many of our concepts for a long period of time. Asphalt barriers are history. They're difficult to take the emulsified, hot, warm asphalt around the world as well as here. I can tell you all the stories you don't want to hear as an EPA person, okay, about asphalt. We're making it very simple. A zero energy input piece of equipment except to pull it through the soil with a tractor that will take a film of polyethylene that's roughly 16 inches wide, 30 centimeters, a little longer. We can develop this into a U-shape all the way to a pretty flat barrier. The CEPAMs, we call them, contoured engineered polyethylene membranes, have perforations based on the infiltration and permeability of the soil. So for a sandy soil, it's just a piece of plastic down across the field. For a loam soil, we have to have a certain quantity of perforations, which is now being produced by the plastic company. And we can install this four at a time, perhaps six at a time, on a piece of equipment behind a pretty good sized tractor.
One last question.
That's a good question. Dow Chemical developed this 58 years ago. They've had it in the soil 52 years. They've tested it every 7 to 10 years. No degradation in 52 years. Longer than 52 years.